This is today's Midland Reporter Telegram and Odessa American, read by volunteers of the Recording Library of West Texas. This production is also available online at recordinglibrary.org and by calling the telephone reader at 432-617-5555.
Watchdog by Dave Lieber, Dallas Morning News. Law banning extra fees on debit or credit card purchase getting trashed. Watchdog, I'm confused. Join the club. What about? The other day I had to pay a surcharge because I bought something with a credit card. The vendor charged an extra fee. I thought that was illegal in Texas. It is, except for governments, but probably not for long. What do you mean? Well, believe it or not, the Texas law has gone all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court, and now it's back in federal court in Austin. Observers are waiting for it to be overturned. Wait, watchdog, start at the beginning. Okay, so back in the 1980s, Texas and other states passed laws pushed by credit card companies to make it illegal for merchants to charge more to customers who pay with credit cards. Texas also added debit cards to the mix. Was that pro-consumer or pro-credit card company? It looked like it was designed to help consumers, but really, the credit card companies didn't want us to know about their swipe fees. They figured if we heard about the higher swipe fees, we'd pay cash to save money. So the state banned surcharges and then made it legal to offer a low cash discount. What are swipe fees? That's the cost to a merchant or a customer, if it's passed on, of the card company's fee to handle a plastic card transaction. Some say swipe fees are an invisible tax that consumers pay to banks and credit card companies. Can you give me an example of a surcharge? Sure. Carol Kelly was about to be charged a 4% surcharge on a vacation rental property. I called the realtor advising them the practice is illegal in Texas, she said. She immediately said the fee would be waived. Are Texas violators punished? There's much confusion surrounding enforcement. Complaints about credit card surcharges were sent to the Office of Consumer Credit Commissioner, and complaints about debit cards went to the Texas Department of Banking. Violators got warning letters, but that was it. No fines? Well, the Texas legislature updated the law last year. They added a $500 fine and gave enforcement power to the state attorney general's office. Did the AG fine anyone? Not that I can tell. One consumer, David Gustoff of Mesquite, told me that when he filed a complaint with the AG's office, he was told they'd keep his complaint on file, but wouldn't take action. Why do you think that is? Probably because of the pending court case. With that hanging over everyone's head, the whole thing is frozen in place. They call it constitutional limbo. This went to the U.S. Supreme Court? Yeah. It started in Texas when some merchants filed a federal lawsuit. They challenged the law on First Amendment grounds. Basically, they claimed they weren't allowed to discuss swipe fees with their customers and to tell them that goods or services would cost more if paid with a plastic card instead of with cash. They claimed this hindered their freedom of speech. That seems a little strange. Maybe so, but it worked in other states like California and Florida, where similar laws were thrown out. A federal judge in Austin ruled that the state law was okay, but then a higher appeals court ruled the other way. The Supreme Court threw the case back down to Austin federal judge for another look, and that's where it stands, waiting on that judge's ruling. If it's overturned, won't the lack of such a law hurt consumers? You'd think so, but Deepak Gupta, the Washington, D.C. lawyer who is suing the state, told me this is false consumer protection. Consumer groups oppose the law because they say it helps credit card companies more than customers. How so? Gupta says the original law was designed to protect the profit of credit card companies. By eliminating extra fees for plastic card payments, merchants picked up the cost instead. Customers, not knowing that the card payments cost more, were not detoured into paying with cash, where no fees and no profits from swiping were involved. How is this a First Amendment issue again? Gupta tells me, the whole idea is to protect the free flow of information to consumers so they make their own choices. He predicts that the Texas law is in its last days. Once it's declared unconstitutional, he says, merchants will be free to tell us how much it costs to use a credit card. They'll have to fully disclose what they're doing. Deepak Gupta is the legal lawyer challenging the constitutionality of Texas's anti-surcharge law. What do Texas lawyers defending the case say? Attorney General Ken Paxton's lawyers wouldn't call me back. Can I ask about cash discounts? Yes, that's currently allowed. When you go to Specs Wine, Spirits, and Finer Foods, for instance, that company correctly shows a regular price and then a cash discount price. Under the law, and this is confusing, businesses can't charge a surcharge, but they can offer a lower price when you pay with cash. Some gas stations do that too. So you're sure the Texas law will be thrown out? Not 100%, but when the U.S. Supreme Court sent it back to Austin and voided a similar New York law at the same time, most observers said they expected that to happen. Tell me again how it is pro-consumer to allow us to pay more for debit and credit card use. Sounds like it's the opposite. I thought so too, but as Gupta says, make it transparent and allow them to choose among different forms of payment. One last question. I went to pay my taxes and the county charged me a surcharge, a convenience fee, but isn't that still illegal under current law? No, to be clear, all governments are exempt from the no surcharge rule. They can charge what they want when you pay any government, and unfortunately, most do. The Texas case is Roel et al. Versus Pettyjohn. It's in U.S. District Judge Lee Yackel's court in Austin. Education briefs. MISD to raise lunch prices. The U.S. Department of Agriculture has mandated that school lunch prices be increased by 10 cents this upcoming school year, according to a press release from Midland ISD. The district's child nutrition services each day provides more than 27,000 meals that meet USDA's dietary guidelines. Quality meals enhances students' ability to process and retain information, heighten concentration skill, and improve scholastic achievement and overall wellness, said Superintendent Orlando Riddick. Helping every child achieve by providing healthy, nutritionally balanced meals is an enhancement to the educational day, and we appreciate the hard work of our Child Nutrition Services team. Lunch prices for 2018-19 will be $3.05 for elementary students, $3.30 for secondary students, 40 cents for students who receive reduced price lunches, and $3.95 for adults. Breakfast will continue to be free for all students. Parents can put money in their students' lunch account at www.midlandisd.net. Click on the Child Nutrition Services icon and select Prepayment Options. Child Nutrition Services will begin accepting applications for free and reduced price meals on Monday. The application may be submitted on the website, Meal Applications under Child Nutrition Services. Applications are also available at each campus and the CNS office, 801 South Moran Street, Building 2. Volunteers needed for energy program. Volunteers, both professionals and students, are being sought to participate in the Energy for Me Energy Education Initiative. The Permian Basin Section Society of Petroleum Engineers is collaborating with the University of Texas of the Permian Basin's STEM Academy and communities in schools Permian Basin on efforts to educate K through 12 students about the importance of energy and practical STEM applications in the energy industry. According to a press release, Energy for Me has lesson plans that volunteers can use in interactive activities and classroom discussions. The initiative will kick off September 4th at UTPB's STEM Academy, 4940 South Road in Odessa. The event will focus on elementary students from 9 a.m. to noon and will include booths and hands-on activities. During the afternoon, the focus will be on middle and high school students and will include a panel of 6th through 12th graders and young professionals to discuss careers and education. The event is expected to involve 600 to 700 students from STEM Academy and Midland and Ector County ISDs. To participate, register online at bit.ly/2A1KS1A before August 26th. Dear Abby, baby in daycare plays favorites. Dear Abby, I'm a child care provider working with infants. Two of us work in the nursery and share responsibilities. One baby has become extremely attached to me, to the point that I can't take a break or go to lunch without him screaming until I return. I feel guilty taking lunch breaks or even a vacation because I know that whoever substitutes for me will have to deal with the crying. Other teachers have tried to bond with him to make it easier on everyone, but it doesn't work. It has reached the point that I'm exhausted at the end of the day from the stress of having to be near him all day. Any suggestions? Mothering in Missouri. Dear Mothering, yes, you are a caring person who is doing more than your share of trying to make the baby feel secure, so stop feeling guilty. I consulted Dr. Faisal Chawla, a pediatrician in Los Angeles, who explained that separation anxiety normally occurs at around 6 to 9 months, so age may be a factor. The baby may be experiencing separation anxiety from you, as others might get it when a parent drops them off at daycare. It should not cause you distress because this is expected behavior. Chawla kindly offered suggestions for coping with separation anxiety. Establish a goodbye ritual routine that's consistent and quick. Comfort the infant and let him or her know you will be back after your break, just as parents would tell their little one when they will be back after work. Some parents do a peekaboo ritual, which can reduce crying goodbyes to ones with much less drama. Leave after you say your goodbye and don't come back repeatedly. Coming back is positive reinforcement for the crying. If I cry harder, they will come back. Dear Abby, my husband had an annoying habit of staring at me. After dinner, if I went into the kitchen while he was still at the dinner table, he would turn his chair around to stare at me. When he walked into a room I was in, he would stop and stare at me. When I finally got sick of it and told him to cut it out, his response was, "Can't you stand scrutiny?" I said it has nothing to do with scrutiny. It's a form of trying to control me, or even mental abuse. He has stopped it for the most part, but he reverts back every once in a while. I still have to mention it at times. What do you think of this? What do you think it means? Annoyed in the East. Dear Annoyed, unless you have left something out of your letter, I don't consider what he is doing to be emotionally abusive. Until you spoke up, he may not have realized he was making you uncomfortable. What I think it means is that your husband thinks you are the most beautiful woman in the world, and he's the luckiest man on the planet. Now he knows it makes you uncomfortable. He's making an effort to stop, but old habits are hard to break, and he occasionally backslides. Sisters to operate new Montessori daycare. Applications to be accepted beginning Friday. Facility to open September 4th. By Simone Jasper. Twin sisters Melanie Thomas and Lauren Tift believe that now is the right time to start a new daycare in Midland. With more than 10 years of combined experience in Montessori education, they want to care for toddlers who come from diverse backgrounds. "We hope to serve children who need Montessori the most," Tift said. Montessori originally was for children that were in lower income situations. At Three Sisters Montessori, the structure includes small group and individual lessons, as well as independent choice offerings. Children will have the opportunity to choose freely from tools that relate to practical life, science, math, language, geography, and the senses. Tift will be the lead teacher at the home-based daycare, which is scheduled to open September 4th. Renovations are almost complete on a 900-square-foot space that includes a main room, nap area, kitchen, and bathroom. "Our classroom will really showcase a calm, peaceful setting," Tiff said. "We won't have anything on the walls. There will be lavender diffusers, things of that nature. The daycare will offer morning and afternoon sessions and start with a schedule that coincides with Midland Montessori School. The sisters have been in contact with the head of the school, where Thomas said parents could send their children starting in pre-kindergarten. We'll start at 18 months and end at 3 years old," Thomas said, "so they'll be able to transition well from our little school daycare straight into the Montessori school. That's what we're hoping." The sisters had long contemplated starting a daycare. They said that recent changes, such as Thomas welcoming a new son and Tift moving back to West Texas from New York, made this an appropriate time for making their idea a reality. "Melanie tends to jump on things quickly," Tiff said. "I would have thought a year or two to do it, but thankfully she went ahead and did it." While working in New York, Tift gained experience related to diversity in Montessori classrooms. She said the educational method appeals to her because it focuses on inclusion and instilling a love of learning through independence. "Montessori often has mixed age grouping, so children learn from children," Tiff said. "They learn self-control. There's only one material per one child." Tiff said Montessori has gained traction in the United States in recent years and hopes the daycare fulfills the needs of local families. To prepare to accept up to 10 children for each session, Tift and Thomas said they're going through state licensing processes. There is demand for qualified daycare in the area, according to Thomas. The sisters think one offering that stands out at their facility could be hands-on experience with gardening and cooking. Thomas said another appealing quality is the daycare's location, which is near Museum of the Southwest. Three Sisters Montessori plans to begin accepting applications on Friday, when renovations to its daycare space are scheduled to be finished. Thomas, who will be working as assistant to Tift, said she looks forward to the steps ahead. "We've had 30 years of experience working together," Thomas said. "We've always been close." For more information about daycare programming at Three Sisters Montessori, email 3sistersmontessori@gmail.com or call 889-6422. Retired teachers look to legislature for money. State predicts there will be less money for educators' benefits, by Sidney Green of the Texas Tribune. After teaching for 36 years in the Rio Grande Valley, Rosalva Reyna looked at her pension and health plan in July 2016 and decided she could live a comfortable life and finally retire. Reyes thought no more work, but that quickly changed, she said. "At this point, I'm seriously considering going back to work," Reyna said. "A retired teacher going back to work so I can pay my medical bills." Texas has a number of retired teachers now worried that their pensions may be lowered next year. The state's Teacher Retirement System Board voted Friday to lower the expected rate of return on investments, meaning the state is predicting it will earn less money to use for benefits. Retired educators said they are now looking to the legislature to make sure more funding is secured for the TRS pension fund in light of Friday's vote. At a time when the cost of living is rising, retired teachers are trying to survive within their fixed incomes, which has been difficult, according to several retired teachers who testified at the board meeting. The board's decision to lower the expected rate of return on investments could signal a potential decrease in pension benefits and contribution rates, which are set by the legislature. And retirees are looking to lawmakers to help offset the new expected rate, said Monty Exter of the Association of Texas Professional Educators. The burden is now on the Texas legislature to step up and provide the necessary funding to ensure actuarial soundness of the pension fund and give educators peace of mind that they will not face cuts in their pensions, Exter said. The decision to lower the rate was based on estimates from financial experts who predicted how the rates would operate in future economic situations. Exter acknowledged that the board had a fiduciary duty to make decisions on the fund based on advice from experts. "We have looked at a variety of forecasts," said Brian Guthrie, TRS's executive director. Guthrie added that it's board's responsibility to look at what actions to be taken in light of updated financial forecasts, a system of determining how current and future fiscal situations could impact policy and other decisions. Despite the board's decision on Friday, Ted Rabe of the Texas American Federation of Teachers said he's confident legislators will provide additional funding after the health care increases in budget cuts. "We've known for many months that it was very likely that the board was going to lower their assumed rate of return," he said. "We're going to be taking our message to the legislature and that they need to make a substantial increase to the state contribution to the pension fund and also to health care for retirees and for other teachers." Rabe said they have allies in the legislature, such as State Representative Terry Canales, Democrat of Edinburgh, who has already asked Governor Greg Abbott to make funding for teacher retirees an emergency item for next session. "My local teachers, who are on a fixed income, are now paying hundreds of dollars more a month, sometimes more, for health care services and essential medications," Canales wrote. "These Texas teachers who have dedicated their lives to public service have increasingly had to make a choice whether to pay their mortgage, buy groceries, or pay for their potentially life-saving medications. Among states that only pay into a pension plan and not Social Security for retirees, Texas is dead last in teacher retirement funding and puts little more than the required minimum into the fund. Retired teachers were moved to political action last summer, urging lawmakers to patch up an underfunded health care program with soaring deductibles and out-of-pocket costs. The legislature added funding to the program, but it wasn't enough to entirely tamp down the costs for most retirees. But Raina said she saw deductibles rise after the legislature's decision, which has caused her to struggle to pay her health care costs. Under her current health care plan with the state, Raina has a deductible of $1,500, but her premium for a year is $2,400, and her medical bills and doctor visits total $1,048. That means Raina is paying $3,448 out of pocket for health care on top of her deductible until her Medicaid kicks in 4 years. Lawmakers say the uncertainty surrounding the budget makes it hard to allocate better benefits for educators. Many teacher retirees are already strategizing to get on lawmakers' radars in order to secure the funding they need to keep their pension stable. Every candidate and every legislator needs to understand the contribution that retired school employees made and the obligation the state has to keep those promises, Rabe said. There's an entire community across Texas that supports public education and understands that keeping our promises to retirees is a part of that. Although the next step for many teacher retirees is to start the fight for funding at the legislature, Rita Runnels said retirees just want respect from lawmakers when it comes to basic survival. We knew we would never become wealthy serving the state of Texas and the families, but we did expect to get decent respect, said Runnels, who was a teacher for 32 years. We thought that our health care would be fair pensions that would last us for a lifetime of serving the state of Texas and Texas families. Hello, this is Joanna reading from the education section from the Midland Reporter Telegram from July 31, 2018. Bynum School. Bynum School is the only public or private school in West Texas that offers an uninterrupted continuum of services for 3-year-olds to adults who have special needs. Bynum School provides effective quality programs and services to students by differentiating instruction, actively engaging students in learning activities, and providing a safe, nurturing, and productive educational setting. Each student is a valued individual who is able to learn skills appropriate for his or her unique abilities. How have you moved beyond the basic curriculum and found innovative ways to teach your students? Each student is assessed for an individualized program plan, IPP, that identifies specific objectives to target each student's needs. Programs are divided into age and ability levels, beginning in preschool and moving through elementary, junior high, high school, vocational, and adult. Curriculum is based on individual needs, general academic skills, lifelong learning, and vocational training. What is the one lesson you want to impart to every student who enters your classroom? At Bynum School, every individual is considered unique and valued. Each student and adult is given the opportunity to learn at their level, be challenged to a high potential, and achieve goals beyond what is expected or predicted. How do you inspire your peers, colleagues, and others aiming to make a difference at Bynum? Every staff member is committed to the mission and vision of Bynum School. Most teaching professionals choose this field for the love and rewards of seeing students grow and advance in their learning. This holds true for the Bynum staff. What are your professional goals for the future? We are transitioning into a new era for Bynum School. The new school and vocational program will allow for increased enrollment and the opportunity to develop and expand academic, social, and behavioral programs. Future plans include a retail store, a full-time residential community, a recreation center, and on-site job opportunities. What is the greatest challenge to being an educator in Midland today? As a corporate educator, Bynum School's greatest challenge is attracting and retaining quality staff. What support can Midlanders provide you and other educators? Bynum School is unique because we are the only year-round private not-for-profit school that provides an uninterrupted continuum of services from ages 3 through adult. Spread the word that this is a viable choice for parents in the Permian Basin. From the Educator Honor Roll, presented by the Midland Development Corporation, which has partnered with the Reporter Telegram to honor teachers and other district officials who make a difference in students' lives.
Hi, this is Rachel reading the Midland Reporter Telegram Educator Honor Roll for Tuesday, September 18, 2018. Amy Heron, Alamo Junior High, Subject, 8th grade social studies teacher. Number of years with MISD, 10. What is your favorite moment in the classroom? I love it when students get excited and enthusiastic about what they are learning. Why did you choose a career in education? I chose teaching because I believe every student deserves to learn and get a quality education. How have you moved beyond the basic curriculum and found innovative ways to reach your student? I use lots of engaging hands-on activities and technology in my classroom. What is the one lesson you want to impact to every student who enters your classroom? I want students to know how much education matters and how valuable historical figures who were denied an education believe it to be. How do you inspire your peers, colleagues, and others aiming to make a difference in MISD? I am energetic about what I am teaching, and I am consistent in wanting to help other teachers become great teachers. What are your professional goals for the future? I want to continue working with students and making a difference in their lives. What is the greatest challenge to being an educator in Midland today? The biggest challenge are a lack of community support for an education bond and the need to find good educators. What support can Midlanders provide you and other educators? I would love for the community to support all education, whether it be sports, the arts, or clubs, and support all forms of learning by volunteering to watch, mentor, and guide students. About Mrs. Herring. Mrs. Herring is a very determined teacher who, one way or the other, is going to get students to the next level of learning. She makes learning fun, and the way she uses so many different out-of-the-box methods to bring excitement to learning 8th grade social studies is awesome to observe. Every year, Mrs. Herring finds ways for herself to learn more about teaching, and she always is willing to attend every conference and workshop, hoping to get new ideas she can use with her students. Her energy is contagious, and the students learn so much, not just social studies, but how to think critically and for themselves. Mrs. Herring is an asset to Alamo Junior High. I am thankful to have her here. She is awesome. Leanne Dumas, Alamo Junior High Principal. To the reader, the Midland Development Corporation has partnered with the Midland Reporter-Telegram to honor teachers and other district officials who make a difference in students' lives. The MDC, as part of a commitment to education, will sponsor this series that will appear every Tuesday on the front of the education section. The MDC and Midland Reporter-Telegram thank Midland ISD for its help with Educator Honor Roll. Student grades are based on inconsistent systems. Jennifer Seibert, Abel Junior High School. In the last month, the big news around education in Texas is the newly released ratings for school districts and campuses. We are now rating our district and our schools using an A through F system. The state released the A through F only for district. For individual schools, the number ratings was released. So for the school that I currently lead, the score of 76 was released. I suppose that makes us a C. What I know, though, is that we have more than C students and C teachers. We have exceptional learners and an extraordinary instructional team. Apparently, though, in the eyes of the state, we are still a C. I also have a fourth grader at a Midland ISD campus that received a number grade that translated to an F. What I know about the campus, though, is that the teachers dedicated an enormous amount of time and energy to my child and helped her find success. But still, the campus was labeled an F. My child, who has traditionally struggled, yet is an amazingly hard worker, found success at an F campus. So, when asked, how can I leave my child at an F campus? The answer is the same. The campus succeeded with my child, and I am confident that they will do the same with more children. Griffin Seibert is a success story, and the F will not define her, nor will it define the teachers who poured into her. As I began to digest and disaggregate the data, I had empathy. What was just done to us, being rated by the state on an A through F scale, is exactly what we do to children across the state every single day, and not just children. But little children, 5 and 6 year olds, we grade our students day in and day out with not much more than a thought of what we are doing to our youngest learners. So please feel free to be outraged at the new school rating system, but please also be outraged at the grades we assigned our students every day. I am a practitioner. I work daily with students, teachers, and parents. Until you have sat with a crying mom who is looking at her first grader's report card with an F for reading, you can't fully understand understand what this does to a child. How do you explain that a first grader, a six-year-old, failed reading? What does that even mean? And does that mean the same thing in every classroom? Does it mean that the child can't read or can't memorize sight words assigned for homework? Does it mean that the child can't sit still during small group? Does it mean that homework is rarely completed? What does an F mean? When searching for the meaning of our newest school ratings, let's also have a conversation about the ratings we give our students, because there most definitely is a connection between the two. I understand that grades are important for high school students and college applications, top 10, scholarships, etc. I have now worked at all levels of education, so I get it that grades are necessary. I also understand that grades are one way to measure performance. There has to be accountability, and grades help to give structure for that. But what worries me is that we are grading students based on inconsistent systems and labeling them before they even have the opportunity to grow. By giving a first grader an F for reading or math, we are pre-selecting that child as a high school dropout. By lining up A honor roll students in front of peers during assemblies, we are highlighting the idea that early success is the only acceptable success. This honor roll system is no different than the state of Texas sending out lists of grades for all Texas schools. They have lined up the A schools in front of us all. And frankly, I am a little bit mad that I am not leading an A school. I am mad because parts of schools are worthy of an A, but those parts aren't measured by the state, just like pieces of our students aren't measured. When our imperfections are highlighted across the state, it causes doom and gloom. It causes teachers to want to give up. This is no different than what it does to our students. Failing students want to give up. So be horrified at the thought of TEA sending out a press release with grades for our schools, but be equally horrified at how we have become entrenched in publicly highlighting students for the exact same thing. Highlighting the A's also shines a very bright light on the F's. I would love a total overhaul of the grading of students and schools. I would love to see developing and mastered as words used on report cards instead of A and F's for both schools and students. So, from my standpoint as a school leader, this makes our PLCs, professional learning communities, so very important. The conversations that our teachers are having during this sacred time with each other can be used to create mastery standards for students and to discuss how students will be measured and graded based on a common standard. Conversations with PLCs can help with standardization of grading, intervention ideas for struggling students, brainstorming for new and innovative methods and techniques, and collaboration with colleagues. We must continue as school leaders to keep this time sacred for our teachers, because the success of students depends on allowing our teachers to have time with each other. What this also means is that when thinking about how we can improve performance, let's think at the student level instead of the school level. Let's look at the individual learners and their potential versus worrying about global school grades that really don't mean much. The grades that TEA made public mean one thing. We must continue to work at reaching our students and help each other individually grow as learners. There is no other way. Jennifer Seibert is a principal at Abel Junior High School. Midland College Profiles by Rebecca Bell. Graduates' determination paves way to success. In May 2004, 18-year-old Adriana Ortega was sitting in her living room and crying as she was holding her infant son and watching the televised graduation ceremony for her high school classmates. Ortega wasn't there because she had dropped out of school 2 years earlier to get married. Watching my friends graduate made me realize that I needed to get a high school diploma, so I started taking GED classes at Midland College. And 3.5 months later, I had a high school diploma, she said. 2 years after Santiago was born, she and her then-husband had a daughter, Karime. When Karime started preschool in 2010, Ortega decided it was time to take her education one step further, so she enrolled in classes at Midland College. I wasn't sure what my major would be, Ortega said. I enrolled in a few business-related classes, and then one day, as I was sitting in a business system class taught by Sylvia Brown, I realized that a business career was my calling. What can I say? I like paperwork. While she was taking classes, Ortega worked full-time as an administrative assistant, was married, and was raising two young children. She graduated from Millen College in 2013 with an Associate of Applied Science degree in Business Systems and soon obtained an administrative assistant position at D&H Pumps. She was also active in Millen College Students in Philanthropy Organization and was a member of the Sigma Kappa Delta, the English Honor Society. I really enjoyed having Adriana as a student, said Sylvia Brown, Business System Department Chair. She was always eager to learn new things. She fully participated in all the classroom activities. I could tell that she has the confidence needed to accomplish everything she sets her mind to do. Ortega enrolled in Millen College again in 2015 to pursue a baccalaureate degree in organizational management. She was able to advance her career when she accepted a position as an administrative assistant working for a local oil field company, Badger Daylighting. However, life wasn't exactly idyllic for Ortega and her family. She and her husband of 15 years divorced in 2016. Despite being a single mother, she was determined to complete her degree. Even though her college tuition was being financed in part through Millen College Uptown Business and Professional Women's Scholarship, Ortega said it was hard to juggle finances. In July of last year, she began working part-time at Kirkland's at Midland Park Mall. It wasn't easy raising a family, working, and going to school, Ortega said. My family had to make lots of sacrifices, but it was worth it. Ortega graduated in May with a Bachelor's of Applied Science Technology in Organizational Management. In June, she celebrated 2 years of employment with Badger. Every student has a different path to graduation, said Ryan Peckman, Organizational Management Associate Professor. Adriana's work ethics and determination have never wavered, and even in the face of adversity, she has persevered. I am proud of her, but more importantly, she should be very proud of herself. Ortega wants to take her career even further. She plans to begin taking paralegal courses or start working on an MBA beginning in January. Rebecca Bell is Executive Director of the Institutional Advancement at Midland College and the Midland College Foundation. Life on the verge of divorce calls for a one-year reprieve. Dear Abby, my husband has less and less interest in me. It started with the last presidential election. Since then, I have cut way back on politics because he doesn't want to hear any of it. Being an activist on several fronts, including politics and other areas, this is a big emotional part of who I am. I get so upset by his silences that I stop talking to him completely. I'm spent from feeling so lonely, so unworthy of love, helpless, hopeless, and powerless. I can't take this much longer. He says he wants to be with me, and he has just started private therapy. I, too, am in therapy. I was ready to draw up divorce papers when I suddenly changed my mind. I told him I'd wait a year for him to have his therapy, and then I'd review everything we'd had learned and proceed from there. Have I made a mistake? Right now, I can't stand to be around him. He can be the world's greatest giver, but other times, he's a selfish, insensitive, arrogant know-it-all. I don't know if I'm still in love with him. Does this proposed one-year respite have any chance of working? Sad wife in Buffalo. Yes, it does. It appears that in the midst of your pain and turmoil, you experience a brief moment of clarity. Your decision to give your husband and yourself a year of therapy and to revisit the issue of divorce was both wise and brilliant. You married each other for a reason. Now give yourselves a chance to remember what it was. Dear Abby, new neighbors moved in a few doors down from us. A few weeks later, they hosted an open house and invited about 15 families from the homes closest to theirs. They served food and graciously gave everyone a tour of their home, which had been completely renovated. My husband and I arrived about the same time as another neighbor, and the three of us visited with our hostess. As she rolled out the red carpet, the other neighbor proceeded to talk about the history of the home, who had lived there, and what the house had been like when she visited there as a friend of the previous owner. She then announced that the man who owned the home years ago had committed suicide in the home. The hostess maintained a gracious stance, but my husband and I were horrified. Should the neighbor be told that her comment was inappropriate? Horrified in the East. Dear horrified, because the comment may have cast a pall over the housewarming, it was inappropriate. However, it may not have come as a complete surprise to the new owners. In the state where I reside, real estate agents are required by law to disclose that there had been a death in the house, suicide, murder, which might affect the value of the property. If you feel the need to say something to the neighbor who made the tasteless comment, by all means, do so. To my Jewish readers, Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, begins at sundown. During this 24-hour period, observant Jewish people fast, engage in reflection and prayer, and formally repent for any sin that might have been committed during the previous Hebrew year. To all of you, may your fast be an easy but meaningful one.
This is the column by Ken Herman, Austin American Statesman. The title of the column, Is It Possible Some Texans Will Vote for Beto and Abbott? General election campaign season is here, and that generally means a bumper crop of bumper stickers and yard signs. But here's one you probably won't see, Beto and Abbott in 18. What kind of politically twisted, tortured soul would vote for GOP Governor Greg Abbott's reelection and Democratic Beto O'Rourke's bid to unseat GOP U.S. Senator Ted Cruz? An unthinkable nutty combination, right? But two recent polls seem to have tapped into an odd cohort of Texans who say that as of now, they're backing Abbott and O'Rourke. Let that marinate for a moment. Oddest couple though it might be, there seem to be Texans planning to vote that combo. This seems like a good place to quote whoever it was, and it looks like it wasn't Winston Churchill who said, "If you want to lose faith in democracy, just spend 5 minutes talking with the average voter." A recent NBC News / Marist poll showed Cruz with 49% over O'Rourke's 45%, with a 3.8 percentage point margin of error. That same poll, of those same voters, showed Abbott with a whopping 56% to 37% lead over Democratic challenger Lupe Valdez. And Emerson College in Boston released its August poll with similarly perplexing results. That poll showed a virtual dead heat in the Senate race. Cruz 38%, O'Rourke 37%, while Abbott had a 48% to 28% edge in the governor's race. That poll has a 4.4 percentage point margin of error. So I called Emerson's Spencer Kimball and ask if the poll was trying to tell me there are Texans planning to vote for O'Rourke and Abbott. That is correct, he told me. Say what? It is surprising, Kimball confirmed. I was surprised by the results. I had expected to see Senator Cruz up by double digits. Kimball said poll numbers show a significant difference in the opinions of independent voters about the two GOP incumbents. The disparities in population in the two elections appear to be driven by independent voters, the pollster said in releasing results. 57% of independents polled said they have an unfavorable view of Cruz. Only 25% said they view him favorably. For Abbott, the numbers among independents were 41% unfavorable and 37% favorable. And among independents, O'Rourke led Cruz by 45% to 25%. Abbott led Valdez in that group 38% to 27%. That's the deal with independents. They're just so not dependent. Abbott is also running stronger than Cruz among Republicans. Kimball theorizes Cruz's problem with some Republicans could date back to the 2016 GOP National Convention speech when Cruz refused to endorse Donald Trump, who had bested Cruz for the presidential nomination. Cruz later backed down and backed Trump, something he does to this very day. Kimball also noted the Emerson poll showed Abbott running stronger than Cruz among men and women, with the latter statistic being particularly notable. The poll showed Abbott up 9 percentage points over Valdez among women, while Cruz trails O'Rourke by 12 points among women. Females are traditionally now voting Democratic, but Abbott is winning the female vote running against a female, Kimball said. Bottom line, he said, is that Abbott certainly is less polarizing than Cruz. Yes, Cruz seems to stir political passions. There are lots of numbers here, so let's try to translate them into words. We'll stipulate that somehow there could be Texans who will vote for O'Rourke for Senate and Abbott for governor. Are there enough of them to help fuel an O'Rourke upset of Cruz? Too soon to say. But it could happen and put O'Rourke in the Senate and quite possibly earn him a mention among potential members of the Democratic 2020 national ticket. It would be unusual and bring us back to a previous Texas political era. For a U.S. Senate race to have a decisively different outcome than a gubernatorial race on that same ballot. Back in 1994, the last time a Democrat won a Texas statewide race, the results were all over the board in the top eight statewide contests. The Republicans won three, topped by U.S. Senator Kay Bailey Hutchinson's 61% to 38% drubbing of Democrat Richard Fisher. The Democrats won five, with the biggest margin being Lieutenant Governor Bob Bullock's 62% to 39% win over the GOP's Tex Lazar. We really should have more candidates named Tex. These days, with political polarization being what it is, it's difficult to imagine such varying results in Texas statewide races. I asked O'Rourke for his best explanation of how somebody could vote for him and Abbott. I don't know how to explain it, he said, launching into an answer that ended with, I increasingly hear people say they're no longer compelled to vote by party, but by the person, by the issues, by what's important to them in their life. In a year when a Democratic upset of Abbott seems highly improbable, that's what O'Rourke is betting on. Final request, let me hear from you if you plan to be a Beto-Abbott voter, especially if you have that bumper sticker on your car. Distributed by Tribune Content Agency.
Obituaries for Wednesday, September 5th. Doyce Ray Todd. Doyce Ray Todd, 83, passed away September 1st. He was born to Pauline and Clarence Todd. He married Colleen Riggins in 1967. Visitation will be held Wednesday, September 5th from 6 to 8 p.m. at Nally Picklin Welch Funeral Home in Midland. Funeral services will be held Thursday, September 6th at 11 a.m. at Calview Heights Baptist Church. A graveside service will follow at 3 p.m. at Mount Olive Cemetery in Big Spring, where Ray will be buried alongside his parents. In lieu of flowers, donations may be made to Calview's mission program. He is survived by his wife, Colleen, son, Kevin, Todd, and wife, Tanya of Monahans, daughter, Karen LeBlanc, and husband, Ray of Midland, sister, Eula Mae McDaniel of Midland, 7 grandchildren, 8 great-grandchildren with one on the way, as well as many cousins, nieces, and nephews. Online condolences may be made at www.npwelch.com. H. M. Walters. H. M. Walters, 89, died September 2nd at his Midland home. Services will be held at St. Paul United Methodist Church Thursday, September 6th, at 1 p.m. H.M. was born October 6, 1928, in Archer City to Herbert and Minnie Walters. He married Virginia Anderson in 1949. He is survived by his wife, Virginia, his children, Mike Walters and Kathy Sanders of Midland, and Laura Fields of Lenora, 10 grandchildren and 15 great-grandchildren. James Edwin Ed Todd. James Edwin Ed Todd, 80, passed away in his sleep August 30th at his Midland home. He was born February 18th, 1938, in Dallas, to James Erasmus Todd and Maurice Williams Todd. Ed is survived by his brothers Gene Todd of Hammond, Louisiana, and Delbert Todd and wife Patsy of Iowa Park, along with a nephew and several nieces. Services will be held at 11 a.m. Tuesday, September 11th, at First Presbyterian Church of Midland, officiated by the Reverend Henry Pendergrass of Mr. Todd's Place of Worship, Christ Church Anglican of Midland. Arrangements are entrusted to Nellie Pickle and Welch Funeral Home and Crematory of Midland. Online condolences may be submitted to npwelch.com. In lieu of flowers, donations in Mr. Todd's memory may be made to the Midland Humane Coalition, Post Office Box 53213, Midland 79710. Nicholas Harvey Thompson. Nicholas Harvey Thompson, 55, of Midland, passed away Saturday, September 1st. He was born January 25, 1963, in Stanton, to Barbara Merriweather. He is survived by two sons, Christopher and Clayton Thompson of Midland, his mother, Barbara Merriweather of Midland, and siblings Vicky Bass of Brownsboro, and Tina Walker and Chad Thompson of Midland. He is preceded in death by his grandparents and a nephew. Arrangements are under the direction of Nellie Pickle and Welch Funeral Home and Crematory of Midland. Online condolences may be made at www.npwelch.com. Richard Dick Hagelstein. Richard Dick Hagelstein, 89, of Midland, passed away Saturday, September 1st. Visitation was held September 4th at Nellie Pickle and Welch Funeral Home. Funeral services were held Wednesday, September 5th at Nellie Pickle and Welch Chapel. He was born July 11, 1929, to Thelma and Max Hagelstein in San Angelo. Dick is preceded in death by his wife of 63 years, Marge. He is survived by his sons Rick Hagelstein and wife Lisa of Midland, Ron Hagelstein and wife Sarah of Midland, and Lee Hagelstein and wife Terry of Mansfield. He is also survived by five grandchildren, six great-grandchildren, and a sister, Anna Emerson of Las Cruces, New Mexico. In lieu of flowers, donations may be made to the Erythromelalgia Association. On the net, erythromelalgia.org, or the American Cancer Society, or a charity of your choice. Online condolences can be made at www.npwelch.com. Stephen Glenn Pitt. Stephen Glenn Pitt, 50, of Midland, passed away September 1st. Services will be held Thursday, September 6th at 2 p.m. at Nellie Pickle and Welch Chapel. Steve was born July 14, 1968, in Omaha, Nebraska, to Norman Pitt and Kay Hestness Pitt. He is preceded in death by his father and is survived by his daughter, Sydney Grace Pitt, mother, Kay Pitt, sisters, Julie and husband, Alan Aiken, Laura and husband, Stuart Ingram, and Valerie Thompson, brother, Jeffrey Pitt, former wife, Tara Tischler, and her children, Jacqueline Maynard and Bradley Maynard, and several grandchildren, aunts and uncles, nieces and nephews. In lieu of flowers, donations may be made to the Midland Children's Advocacy Center at mrccac.org, or the Midland Animal Shelter Adoptables, midlandpets.org, in Steve's name. Online condolences may be made at www.npwelch.com. Sue Eileen Roberts. Sue Eileen Roberts, 77, passed away September 4th at Midland Memorial Hospital. She was born in November of 1940 in Jacksonville, to Cecil R. and Minnie L. Wagoner. Sue was preceded in death by her parents and her sister Rita. She married Ross D. Roberts in 1960. She is survived by her husband Ross D. Roberts of Midland. She is also survived by her daughter Teresa Newman and husband Mike of Midland. her daughter Sherry Mahaffey and husband Steve of Carthage, her son Ross Roberts Jr. and wife Susie of Anacortes, Washington. She's also survived by 7 grandchildren. Sue will be buried in Andrews in a private family ceremony. A celebration of life service will be held at St. Luke's United Methodist Church in Midland, September 6th at 1 p.m. In lieu of flowers, the family requests that donations be made to Midland Memorial Hospital Auxiliary, 400 Rosalind Redfern Grover Parkway, Midland 79701, or Hospice of Midland, 911 West Texas, Midland 79701. Arrangements are under the direction of Nally Picklin Welch Funeral Home and Crematory of Midland. Online condolences may be made at www.npwelch.com. Death notices. Alvino Heredia Reyes. Alvino Heredia Reyes, 81, of Midland, passed away Saturday, September 1st. Viewing will be Wednesday, September 5th from 9 a.m. to 9 p.m., with rosary starting at 7 p.m. Wednesday evening at Llewellyn Garcia Pipkin Funeral Home Chapel. Funeral Mass is set for Thursday, September 6th at 9 a.m. at Our Lady of Guadalupe Parish and Shrine. Burial will follow at Rest Haven Memorial Park. He is survived by his wife, Miquela Reyes, 3 sons, Alvino Reyes Jr., Ricky Reyes, and Edward Reyes, 1 daughter, Anna Reyes Lopez, and 2 sisters. Ashley Mitchell. Ashley Mitchell, 35, of Midland, passed away Sunday, September 2nd. A wake service will be held from 6 to 8 p.m., Friday, September 7th, at Nally Picklin Welch Chapel in Midland. A funeral service will be held at 11 a.m. Saturday, September 8th, at True Light Christian Fellowship. Phyllis Granny Cross. Phyllis Granny Cross of Midland passed away August 8th. Memorial services will be held at Cotton Flat Baptist Church Saturday, September 8th. At 10 a.m. She is survived by her son, Tom Cross.
The article is entitled, West Texas Has Done Well for Lone Star State. Guest view from the Amarillo Globe News. Recent history indicates that the Lone Star State has been served well by West Texas. 2 of the past 3 speakers in the Texas House of Representatives hailed from West Texas. Pete Laney, a Democrat from Hale Center, and Tom Craddock, a Republican from Midland. It may be hard these days for some to imagine a Democrat serving as Speaker of the House, but it happened. Laney and Craddock led the House from 1993 to 2009, so there is recent precedent for the Speaker to be from West Texas. Now comes another legislator from West Texas, Amarillo to be exact, who is vying to be Speaker. State Representative Four Price, Republican from Amarillo, confirmed Thursday what has been a rumor for months. He wants to be the next Speaker of the House. For reasons that are obvious, Price's official filing creates optimism in these parts. West Texans are well aware that the western part of the state, if not most everything west of Interstate 35 and the Metroplex, is far too often overlooked in Austin. For this reason, having a speaker who understands that Texas is more than Dallas, Houston, and Austin is to be applauded. However, there are other reasons to support Price's campaign for speaker. And here is one reason that should matter to Lubbock and Amarillo, the proposed Texas Tech Veterinary School in Amarillo. The controversy surrounding the departure of recently retired Texas Tech Chancellor Robert Duncan and the relationship to the vet school has been well chronicled. If there is indeed some sort of behind-the-scenes political attempt to thwart the vet school, then having a House Speaker who understands that there is a legitimate need for the school certainly cannot hurt. Then there is this. Price has a well-earned reputation as a conservative, and anyone who might argue otherwise is disingenuous or not paying attention. The lawmaker has earned accolades for his work reforming the state's mental health system, just one of his highlights as a state representative. And while Price is a proven conservative, this does not mean he refuses to listen or consider viewpoints and ideas from the other side of the political aisle, a rarity these days. There is a long way to go in the process to select a House Speaker, a process that is done by House members themselves. Price is one of seven who have filed for Speaker, and there is serious competition, including another lawmaker from West Texas, Drew Darby, Republican San Angelo. However, Price throwing his name in the mix is good news. Distributed by Tribune Content Agency.
That's all for today's Midland Reporter Telegram and Odessa American, read by volunteers of the Recording Library of West Texas. This production is also available online at recordinglibrary.org and by calling the telephone reader at 432-617-5555.